This is Car Expert.
It's going to terrify its competitors that it's actually able to offer such a massive discount in exchange for getting vehicles on the road.
The pace is there and the performance is there, and it makes it seem like pretty good value.
I think they've really turned a corner in recent years. They've obviously dropped their controversial design language that brought us things like the Stavic.
It's the first time I've sort of put my nose next to a seat and smelt it, because it just smelled so nice. That leather is crazy.
Hello, my name is Mandy Turner, and this week I'm joined by Mike Costello.
Hello, Mandy.
And William Stopford.
Hey, Mandy.
Moco, the Isuzu D-Max, the safety ratings came out for this, and it's interesting how they do their testing for these, isn't it?
It really is. So ANCAP has upped its game for 2020. It's back up and running now. It's obviously been delayed a bit due to the COVID situation, but they've ramped up their protocols. And the D-Max is one of the first cars to get tested against this new regime, where they put a lot more focus on testing the active safety systems. There's some really good footage of a rolling mule stopping, and then the D-Max behind it, you know, its AEB system kicking in and hauling it in, and its lane assist system doing the job. And as well as, you know, slamming cars into walls, they're actually, and look, they've always tested these systems, but it seems like they've elevated it to another notch. And to watch the degrees of testing that they're doing, and then to consider the fact that this is essentially a tradie special, a dual cab pickup truck that has all of these modern safety features in it that, you know, 10 years ago were the province of a Mercedes S-Class, it really brought it home for me just how far we've come. And I thought, you know what, this is five stars ain't necessarily five stars. This is a five-star 2020 result that's really something else. And I don't know, when I was thinking about interesting things from the week, I think watching that was probably the most interesting thing I saw.
That's up at the site now, yeah, so people can go and have a look at it.
Yeah, cool. It is indeed. And I just thought, you know what, I love to talk about supercars and EVs and things, but utes are what people buy, and if utes today are that safe, that's bloody interesting.
Yeah.
And ANCAP had some very nice things to say about the fact that Isuzu's rolled out this entire suite of active safety technology across the entire D-Max range. It's got some features that you can't find on even the Hilux and the Ranger, which were the kind of the reigning safety champs. And
hell, it's not even standard on a Bentley Bentayga. Like, you know, it's next level.
Very, very cool. All right. Well, that's a little bit of news for this week, but we'll get stuck into the proper car news now. A massive week in car news, and it starts off with probably one of the biggest news stories this week, Moco. The 2021 Hyundai Tucson has finally been revealed.
Yeah, in a normal week, this would be the absolute top story, wouldn't it? But it's only one of the top stories this week. Obviously, the medium SUV market is the most important market for a lot of brands. It's the number one segment by share in the country. More than one in five of all vehicles bought this year has been a mid-sized SUV, led by the Toyota RAV4. And Hyundai with the Tucson has been a really strong player in that market for quite some time. And the new Tucson has been launched, and it's going to hit Australia in the first half of 2021, and it is a massive departure from the outgoing car. So first of all, it's quite a bit bigger. There's two wheelbases globally, short wheelbase and long wheelbase. We're only going to get the long wheelbase, which is 150 mils longer than its predecessor, and it's actually longer than a RAV4, so it's pretty big for the class. It's got carryover engines, 2-litre, 1.6 turbo and 2-litre diesel. There's no confirmation yet of whether we're going to get the hybrid or the plug-in hybrid, though it's pretty much a formality that we'll get at least one of those, considering so many competitors in the market are preparing to launch their hybridised cars. But perhaps most interestingly is the design of this thing. It is a incredibly bold-looking car, and we knew it would be because Hyundai teased this car repeatedly leading up to the launch. But it really does look quite bold. It's almost got the kind of curves, the parabolic curves and the weird sheet metal creases of what you'd expect a Lamborghini Urus to have, which is a strange comparison, I know, but it's one that I immediately thought of. Plus, it's got a pure Mercedes EQC nose on it as well, this massive grille with integrated LEDs. It looks really interesting. I really want to see it in the metal to know for sure, but I have to say it is one of the boldest-looking mid-sized SUVs I've ever seen, and when you consider how bland the predecessor was, that's definitely a major step. Whether it's positive or negative depends on your persuasion. Inside, heaps of tech, wireless phone charging, wireless Apple CarPlay, two different Bluetooth connections, one for music, one for audio, twin 10-inch digital screens. This really lovely interior design, actually. The whole center face shield looks a little bit like a smart watch in the way that it's laid out. I think it's really clever. And it borrows from the Santa Fe in the sense that it has a lot of really upmarket materials used in it now. So compared to the outgoing car, it's not just more adventurous on the outside, but it's far higher tech on the inside. Carryover engines for now, but as I said, those hybrids are pretty much a formality to come at some point. And, you know, with the Aussie suspension tune locked in, including all, you know, different dampers and springs and shocks and bars and bushes and all those sorts of things that they do here, should be good to drive. And then followed up by a N-line version. There's not going to be a full-on N version, but the N-line version with 215 kilowatts for a proper hot SUV as well. So massive step for the brand. Should be its top seller when it launches. And I don't know, what do you guys think of the look? Did it grab you like it grabbed me?
It's a fascinating design, and I think that's the really interesting thing about Hyundai is they kind of go through these waves of really adventurous design. We first saw in the mid to late 90s with the second generation Lantra and the third generation Sonata. They tried just like a really daring new design language. I think a lot of those designs were coming out of their Californian studio at the time, but then they seemed to tone things down next time around. And then we saw with the current Sonata's predecessor, the i45, that was really bold for a midsize sedan. But while it was really popular in the US, it wasn't as popular in China, so they toned that down again. And we saw the last generation of Hyundai's had very, you know, crisp, not conservative, but very crisp and simple lines. And the Tucson, the current Tucson's really only been around for a few years, but I don't know, it just kind of gets lost in the fray stylistically. But this new one, when I saw photos of it, I was like, wow, because I need to see it in person to figure out if I like the way those side creases are, because there's a lot of creasing on the side, there's a lot of accent lines, and but the front and rear, just wow, very well done.
Panel shops are gonna love the Tucson.
Yeah, they are. You're not going to want to get a little dent or ding in it. It's they've also borrowed not just the actually now think about it, they've not just borrowed that EQC grill from the Mercedes-Benz. They've also borrowed a feature that Mercedes makes a big deal of, which is multicolored interior ambient lighting, which I know kind of sounds like a little bit of a sort of meh, who cares point, but one of the real keys to Mercedes-Benz's growth, I think, has been the fact that its interiors have so much bling. You get in one and you can change, you know, it's got all these different color accents that you can use through different light piping signatures, and you've got fragrances that pipe through the interior. And if you're doing the test of sitting in a car in a showroom for 5 minutes, it's going to blow you away, right? And I think that Hyundai is going down a similar road with this car, because that interior, it's all screens, it's all lights, it's all wild and crazy shapes and textures. And I can easily see somebody who's not convinced just sitting in it for 5 minutes and just, you know, signing on the dotted line from that, just because the design is so bold. And I think, Will, you hit the nail on the head before when you said the old one kind of got lost a little bit, because it was a bit of, it was always a good car, but it never really did anything incredible. And I think Hyundai realizes that to stand out, it really has to go bold. And, you know, credit to it, it's taken a massive risk. And, you know, just I'd like it to see it rewarded for that, frankly.
And color adjustable ambient lighting is such a pointless gimmick, but it's a gimmick that I absolutely love. I love it.
Me too. It's like a guilty pleasure feature of a car, isn't it?
Exactly.
Hey, if you want to tell us what you think of the Tucson, email us podcast@carexpert.com.au. In more other big news this week, Will, the Nissan Z Proto concept has been revealed, and boy, it looks so production ready, doesn't it?
Yes, and we heard from the Nissan design boss, Alfonso Albiza, and he said, look, I'm not touching it anymore. My work here is done. It's onto the engineers for the kind of final R&D stage there. So if you don't like the way it looks, sorry, that's how it's going to look. If you do like the way it looks, like me, then you'll be pretty happy. Now, they haven't specifically confirmed yet what its underpinnings are. There's suggestion that it's they use a revised version of the outgoing 370Z's platform. They haven't confirmed the specs other than it is a twin turbo V6 with a 6-speed manual as standard, but we believe that it is the a variation of the 3-liter twin turbo V6 that was in the Infiniti Q60 Red Sport. So that's 298 kilowatts of power and 475 newton meters of torque in that application. So that's nothing to sneeze at. And it's quite a big jump from the 370Z as well in terms of power. Now, there will be a 6-speed manual, which, I mean, is news in and of itself. The Supra doesn't have a manual, and a manual look isn't a given nowadays, even in sports cars. But we would expect the 7-speed automatic or another automatic transmission to be available. They're calling it Z Proto for now. Well, they're calling the prototype Z Proto, obviously. It's in the name. we expect that it will use the name 400Z, just to kind of continue with that linear progression of the names. And look, it's a very, very interesting design as well, because the proportions look a little bit similar to the 370Z, but the details are very different. They've gone for a mix of retro and modern design. So it's not a complete throwback stylistically, but there are elements that have been inspired by past Z cars. The headlights are actually inspired by the Fairlady ZG version of the first generation 240Z that was only sold in the Japanese domestic market. So those kind of sugar scoop headlights had a glass cover over them. So that's where the headlight inspiration came from. And the taillights, this is what I find really interesting because, I mean, look, so many car companies look back to the 50s and the 60s as like a golden era of design, and then they take inspiration from there. So we can see it with, you know, the current Camaro, the current Mustang, and all of those. But with the tail lights, they've actually drawn inspiration from the Z32 generation of Nissan 300ZX, which was sold during the first half, sold throughout the 90s. So I'd be very curious to see if that's just kind of a one-off thing, or if car companies are going to start looking towards the 90s for inspiration, because were a lot of nice designs then. Like, I know it still seems quite fresh in our minds, and that there's no kind of nostalgia yet, but it's very interesting what they've done with the taillights.
If you're a Japanese brand, why would you not hark to the late 80s, early 90s? That was when the Japanese industry was at its absolute peak. It was before the bubble burst. And it's also worth noting, I think, that Z32 300Z also had a twin turbo V6. So this new car kind of does hark to that in more ways than one. I just hope, having spent lots of time driving that Infiniti Q60 Red Sport, I love the engine. Great engine, and it's got more power than a Supra, which is good. I just hope whoever calibrated the lumpy ride and the crappy steering by wire and the undisciplined chassis dynamics isn't put in charge of the 400Z or the Z Proto or whatever it's going to be called. I know that the 370Z was always a bit workmanlike in the way it drove, but I think there are the bones there to sort of update it, and I hope they go down that road. I loved the picture this week of the CEO of Nissan. And I forgot his name right. Well, is it Makoto Uchida? There was a picture of him from 1993 in the driver's seat of his Z32 300Z, looking very suave indeed in peak early 90s fashion, sort of big baggy Hawaiian style shirt, hanging out the side of it. So you know that the boss of Nissan is a mad Z guy. He was before he even had to be. And it's nice to know that Nissan, I guess, still has a bit of passion for its roots. So I think everybody took a bit of a sigh of relief that Nissan hadn't stuffed up the Z.
And it's especially interesting, too, that it's going to a twin-turbo V6 because there is precedent there. There have been turbocharged six-cylinder engines available across, three different generations of Z car in the past. But the indication is that this is actually the only engine that's going to be available, which does make me think, though, what price point we're going to be looking at when it is introduced, because the current 370Z starts around, what, the low 50s?
Yeah, low 50s and 60 for the Nismo. But then Supra's sort of 85 to 95. So
exactly.
Probably needs to straddle the two. The other interesting thing about this car is it's absolutely not going to be sold in Europe because it cannot meet the emission regulations in Europe with such a powerful engine. Obviously, when you have range fleet-wide emissions standards, you have to make sure that you don't have outlier vehicles where possible. What that does mean, though, is that Nissan can really go all out and turn up the wick on the engine as much as it wants because it can't get into Europe regardless. It doesn't have to detune it for Europe. So for markets like the United States and Australia, it can just tune it as much as it wants, which tells me that it might actually go like the clappers.
Does that mean it can be very loud too?
Well, theoretically it does.
Hope so.
Fingers crossed.
All right, moving on to some warranty news now. There could be a possibility of Mitsubishi overtaking Kia, SsangYong and MG with their 7-year new car warranty. Now, this is providing it will be approved by the Australian Consumer and Competition Commission, the ACCC. Mitsubishi is planning to move from its 5-year warranty to 10 years. Or 200,000 Ks for private and business owners with fewer than 5 vehicles and who maintain their cars in the Mitsubishi Australia dealer network. It's all part of its capped price service program. So that means if it does go ahead on October 1, Mitsubishi will have the honours of being the industry-leading standard warranty. If you decide to take the car to an independent mechanic, you'll have to settle for the 5-year warranty it currently offers or the occasional 7-year promotional warranty you do see come up every now and again. So, guys, it'll be interesting to see if this will affect the sales of the Triton positively, bringing it maybe further up because it's now third place, I think, above the Hilux and the Ranger. So a bigger warranty is always appealing.
Well, I think there's two interesting points to this. One is the distance limit. So a lot of brands have unlimited distance limits on their warranties. But also I think car brands are now at the point where they make their money servicing your cars, not selling your cars. Profit margins on low-end mainstream vehicles are actually pretty low. And people sometimes overestimate how much money car brands make selling vehicles. Sometimes you may only make $100 or $200 selling a car. But you do make money servicing them. And if you make a long warranty contingent on continuing to service your car at Mitsubishi, they get what they want. And, you know, they're a brand with older tech that's proven that probably is less likely to break. So I think you're going to see a lot of brands realize that the only way they can convince people to go back to the dealer time and time again for servicing is to offer a warranty contingent on it. And I think a lot of brands will be watching this very closely indeed. But, of course, if you're on the fence about a car and it has a 10-year warranty, well, you know, it's permission to buy, really, isn't it?
Do you think it's helped with Kia's success in climbing those sales charts every month?
Absolutely. I think Mitsubishi's reputation is already pretty bulletproof. I think Kia's reputation at the time was nowhere near as good as Mitsubishi's was. Some have deserved because of, you know, some of the issues it had early on, particularly with the first Carnival. Some of it just because people didn't trust a Korean brand. But Kia itself has said, you know, its CEO here has said that that warranty was the absolute permission to buy that people needed. They were on the fence about Kia. Do I take a punt? Do I take a risk? And I think MG is doing the same thing now, which is, you know, maybe I'm not going to trust this brand, but you know what? If there's a 7-year warranty or a 10-year warranty, well, damn, you know, I've got nothing to lose, right? So I think it's a huge part. And I think Mitsubishi's reputation is pretty good, but there's no doubt that it will get a few more people over the line and for resale value too.
Yeah. Speaking of getting over the line, this is really exciting news. Toyota now has a hot hatch, Moko.
It does have a hot hatch, and what a hot hatch. The GR Yaris. Now, this is an incredibly interesting story because we saw the Yaris get revealed not long ago in its hybrid and petrol forms, and we just went, what the hell? It's the most overpriced car of all time. Credit to it. It's also the safest light car ever tested. So, you know, it's sort of a premium product in that sense. But we knew that this ultra-low sort of production, hardcore World Rally Championship-derived GR Yaris, you know, we thought it was going to be hugely expensive, 60 grand some people were suggesting, but it's actually a lot cheaper than that. So 49,500 before on roads is its nominal price. But here's the big but. The first 1,000 people, and you can place a deposit now for $1,000, the first 1,000 buyers are going to get it for $39,950. Drive away. So a $10,000 saving off the top, or more than $10,000 saving off the top for buying it in the first 1,000 from the first delivery. So that's incredible. And you have to sort of wonder, well, what's going on here? And the quotes really do lie. The quotes from Sean Hanley really do sort of expose the truth, where he's saying, you know, we want to excite as many fans. And I should say, Sean Hanley is the Vice President of Sales and Marketing for Toyota Australia. And he said, we want to excite as many fans as possible with a price that makes GR Yaris more appealing. He wants GR to be a market-leading performance brand, is his quote. And he's committed to it for the long term. So reading between the lines, they're basically selling this car at cost to, you know, essentially get cars on the road to create the reputation and image that they need. Because if there's one thing, you know, people may not be, you know, thinking about Toyota as being, it's a hardcore rally-derived performance brand. So it's no doubt going to, you know, terrify its competitors that it's actually able to offer such a massive discount in exchange for getting vehicles on the road. And this is no normal Yaris. I mean, this is a 200 kilowatt, 370 newton meter toting all-wheel drive small car. So it's the world's most powerful three-cylinder engine. 0 to 100 in 5.2 seconds. It only weighs 1,280 kilos despite having all-poor traction. Bespoke suspension, a wider track than the road car. Looks like an absolute beast. And then above that, next year, we're going to get 250 units of one called the Rally, with an E on the end, the Rally, the European spelling of Rally, which has race suspension, locking diffs at both ends, BBS wheels, Pilot Sport 4 tyres from Michelin, and red brake calipers. So even more turned up to the wick. And this is going to be the first GR vehicle. Well, we've already got Supra, of course, but this will be the first in a run of GR vehicles, including a GR Corolla and the next 86, which will adopt the GR nomenclature as well. So, you know, this is not some token gesture like I perhaps thought it might be, of Toyota just offering a kind of token Yaris at the top of the range for a handful of lunatics. This is a serious player dominating the performance car market in Australia. And I reckon a lot of competitors from Volkswagen and Renault and Honda and all those other brands are probably going to be quietly quivering in fright at what Toyota's planning.
It's amazing the price differences. So the top range Yaris that you can get now is 32,100 before on roads for the ZR Hybrid, but for an extra $7,000, you can get the GR Yaris.
200 kilowatt manual gearbox, all-wheel drive rally car, which obviously is going to appeal to a different buyer, to a sort of hybrid city car, but what a steal. I mean, that's unbelievable.
Yeah. What do you reckon, Will?
Well, look, we spoke before about the 90s being a golden era for Japanese automakers. You know, there were all of these different coupes, all of these different turbocharged engine options, and Toyota had the MR2, they had the Supra, they had the Celica GT4, they had so much. And now it's like Toyota's harkening back to that era, because we've got a Supra, we've got an 86, it's a little bit old, but there's a new one coming, and now we've got this. And this can only do wonders for Toyota's image here, because, look, they may be number one easily by far, but they've often had a quite a conservative kind of staid image. So now to have things like this in a showroom, kudos.
And I'll give a little plug now to our news editor, Scott Colley, who I sub-edited a column of his yesterday. I think it'll be live by the time you're listening to this. Talking about this very thing of Toyota's mission to not just be a player in the performance hot hatch market, but actually dominate it. And the role that this will play. And he's got some more comments from the company on those lines. So if you sort of want to understand why the company has taken this extraordinary gesture of underpricing its performance halo while overpricing all the others, go and check that out, because it's actually a really interesting look into what Toyota's planning at the moment.
Want the BMW M5 competition, but your pockets aren't deep enough? Well, our performance reviewer and race car driver, Chris Atkinson, might have your answer. The BMW M550i. He took it for a blast around a racetrack in Queensland, and he joins us now to tell us how it all stacked up. Hey, Edco.
Hey, guys. How you doing?
Yeah, good, thank you. Look, I would never have thought a big luxury car like this one could handle a track. Before you got in the driver's seat, how did you think the car was going to go?
I didn't have high expectations for it, and I think that's why I got the biggest surprise, because the time it did, although, as I said in the review, it wasn't easy to do the time because it isn't a track-focused car, but the time it did in the end was amazing, and it was fun. Like I say, it's not a track-focused car, but that engine and that power and torque just really dragged it around the track. And the way BMW seemed to be setting up their cars, this car just fell right in the sweet spot of being able to do a good time.
So a V8 engine, I want to know how this one went.
It felt amazing. And I think it was a cold morning as well. Like everything was in its favor. You know, the turbos, love that with that slightly denser air. And it was just really smooth power as well. So it was really easy to just feed the throttle in. I had my questions about the xDrive system. I wasn't quite sure with it. That was my first real experience of on the track. I've since driven the M8, so I have a bit better understanding with it now. But I actually think definitely on corner exit, that has a nice balance. It has almost like a slightly rear drive feel to it, which allows you to get a nice exit but still not lose traction. So I thought that was quite clever. And I've noticed that BMWs tend to try and set up their chassis, it seems, quite pointy, like the front end's like really strong and the car sort of can turn quite easy. But the only way to get the most of it on the track was to turn basically all the safety controls off because they were sort of interfering the whole time. So it was a bit of a handful when I did that.
Did it feel like a big car on the track?
Not crazy, actually. And I took our boards for a lap in it at the end. I said, you've got to see this thing on the track, because I was able to throw it around. I drove it literally like a rally car. You couldn't just guide it around. You had to tell it what to do. You had to sort of send it in there. But it responded well to that. I just literally threw it into each corner and dealt with it. And if I could get settled by the mid-corner, then I could just pick up that throttle and drive off it. Like I said, the balance was good off the corner. So it definitely didn't feel as big as you'd think. Like change of direction and everything like that was excellent.
Yeah, Atco, I guess just more philosophically speaking, with these xDrive style all-wheel drive systems, a lot of brands that do them talk about the fact that, you know, they can allocate a significant chunk of the engine's torque to the rear axles and then control it from there with a diff and make it almost feel like a rear-wheel drive car. Do you get the sense that an all-wheel drive vehicle like this has the ability to feel like a big traditional rear-wheel drive car, or does that argument not really stack up?
It gets close. It's like it calms it all down for the driver, and it really is somewhere in between. It's not like a pushy understeery all-wheel drive sort of old school car, which is great because you don't really want that in this style of car. And I think if it was completely sort of aggressive system, you'd just have a bunch of understeer, and it doesn't have that. So that's a real positive. And it's just a funny one because I did have a few question marks over the M550 in terms of a few times I just lost the rear a little bit, especially when I leant on a curb. And I think that was actually down to the damping rather than the xDrive, because it just seemed to behave a little bit differently than I'd expect. And I think the damping was just so soft, and then when I was loaded, it just couldn't support what I was asking. But off the corner, excellent. My big issue is into the corner. So basically my feeling is that they create these really pointy, sharp cars, which is the opposite of many, say, Japanese brands that make understeering cars so you don't go off straight into the trees. These guys have said, okay, we're going to set up a car that actually turns really well and then calm it down with all the safety systems. So the hard part was I'd throw it in and then the safety systems would sort of, the stability control would catch it straight away and straighten it back up. And I was like, I can't do a time like this. So straight away I turned off all those settings. And the first thing I had was into turn two, which is a pretty quick corner. I don't know what we go in there at 130, 140 K an hour maybe. And the rear just stepped out of me. So I was going backwards into turn two and going, what's going on here? And luckily I've done a few years of rally, so I managed to catch it and get out the other side. But that sort of philosophy seems to have made these cars that can do a decent lap time, even though they're not designed to. But on the other hand, for the average punter, I wouldn't be going and turning those safety systems off, because it is quite a nervous car and doesn't behave on entry like an all-wheel drive car. For me, you need more control on the entry. You need to be controlling the diffs, have a little bit more locking across the diffs on entry to calm all that down. But they've just said, okay, we'll leave it how it is with this system. I don't 100% understand how they've done it, but they've just controlled it basically with the electronics rather than actual mechanical locking.
I have to say, Atco, I really admire your humble approach just now, saying that you've done a few years of rallying, said by a guy that was a World Rally Championship driver for years. I love the humbleness. I can't let you get away with that.
Yeah. No, I really should be able to catch a slide if it happens. But you never know. Like, I was surprised when it went, and I was like, oh, let's step on the gas and get out of here.
Echo, do you remember the list of lap times and what cars it has beaten?
Quite a few, because it jumped straight to a 57.2, I believe, and that was straight into like number two at that time. The GT4 is still the number one. Since then, the 911. Carrera 4S, which was a cabriolet, did a very similar time, but it's taken down the A45 AMG, the Supra, which are obviously more sporty performance style cars, and then things like the S4 and S3. We haven't had really an equivalent variant from another brand yet, I would say, of that sort of power, but in a more sort of relaxed chassis. And I guess the big question will be when the M5 comes out and we do a lap in that, how much faster it will be, or if it will be any faster. Because quite often when you get everything a lot stiffer and firmer, like to give that feeling of raciness, it doesn't always create time. Like, you look at a lot of the best race cars in the world, and they're soft and they're malleable. Like, you can use curbs and you can squat the car, and the time on a racetrack isn't just in the corner. Time's on the straight. It's about how do you make that straight as long as possible and achieve that in the best way. And even if you're slow in the apex, like this car was, say compared to some of the other more dynamic cars, because it was so good off the corner, I could slow it down in the middle of the corner, square it up, and make the straight so much longer, use that softness and that traction and drive that off the corner. And that's how I did the time in this. It wasn't fast around the corners. It's not a race car, but it was about using what it offered to get the best lap time.
And yet it's done a lap a single millisecond slower than a 911 Carrera 4S, albeit a cabrio, which isn't the quicker body style, but 57.23. Impressive. So it was almost a full second quicker than the Mercedes-AMG A45S, which is obviously less powerful, but on a tight, small track like this, you'd think an all-wheel drive pocket rocket might have an advantage. And a 3.9 second 0 to 100 time for a giant two-ton sedan like this, which isn't even the performance leader, just makes me think, holy crap, how good is that M5 going to be?
Yeah, and this fits in a nice window. Like I said, it's going to be interesting whether that M5 is going to be dramatically quicker. Like, we hope so, and I'm sure BMW hopes so. But I was just generally impressed with that car, and really, you're not going to go track this car, are you? That's not the idea of it. But the pace is there, and the performance is there, and it makes it seem like pretty good value.
Nobody's going to track it, but we're very glad that you did.
I'm glad I got you as well.
I love these chats. You can have a look at the BMW M550i performance review now live at carexpert.com.au. And Chris Atkinson, thanks for your time.
Thanks. Good to catch up again, guys.
There's some sharp deals going around for the current gen Hyundai Tucson in readiness for the 2021 model. But before you consider it, do some shopping around, as you might stumble upon the SsangYong Corando for around the same price. Marco, you've actually done a comparison between these guys. Why did you choose to put the Corando head-to-head with the Tucson?
It does require some explanation, doesn't it? Because as we've just discussed, there is a brand new Tucson on the way, and yet I'm about to run a test with the old one. And so why? Well, there's still 6 months for the old one left to run until a new one arrives, and that means deals. It means that you are going to get a hell of a deal on it, which makes me think, who are some people out there that are after a deal on an SUV? They're probably the sort of people that would consider a relatively unknown brand like SsangYong. which is also Korean, just like Hyundai, and which sells a car called the Corando that on paper stacks up brilliantly against the Tucson. So the question then is, do you buy the car from the unknown brand that has a hell of a lot on the spec sheet, or do you buy the car from the brand that you know but which has far fewer features? So it's the top-of-the-range Corando Ultimate and the low-level, second-from-base Tucson Active X. They're both priced around the $36,990 drive-away mark. $36,990 drive-away for the SsangYong, and at the moment the Tucson's $34,990 drive-away, but its list price is slightly higher. But realistically, in the real world, you're going to get these cars for more or less the same amount of money. They're about the same size, but I'm going to give you a bit of a rundown of the extra features that the SsangYong gives you for the money. So it has climate control, not manual AC, heated and ventilated front seats, heated rear seats, a heated steering wheel, fully digitized LCD driver instruments, active cruise control instead of passive. And then on the safety front, it has extra tech, including AEB that works at high speeds, not just at urban speeds, thanks to the fitment of a radar, blind spot monitor, and rear cross traffic alert. On top of that, while the Tucson has a naturally aspirated 2-litre petrol engine that you really need to rev a lot to get anywhere, the SsangYong's got a great little 1.5-litre turbo that has about 80 newton metres more torque to play with, and all of that from far lower in the rev band. So more power, more safety, a lot more equipment for the same outlay. You start to think, you know, wow, this whole SsangYong thing might actually be all right. And it's quite funny to spend time in it. It reminded me a little bit of that MGHS that I reviewed a few weeks ago, in the sense that it's 90% there. There's a little bit of polish missing that the Aussie-engineered Tucson offers in terms of the way that it handles bumps and the way that its body stays nice and flat through corners that the SsangYong can't quite match. But for most people who aren't going to really pay close attention to dynamics, the SsangYong's actually perfectly fine. And then when you consider the extra equipment, the fact that its cabin space is about the same, you really do start to come around to the idea. And then we spoke about warranties earlier on in the podcast, and it's worth mentioning here that SsangYong is a brand with a 7-year warranty, which is 2 years longer than Hyundai's, and its cars also cheaper to service, so $295 a pop with annual servicing intervals. And I think you really do arrive at the argument of SsangYong is a brand that a lot of people overlook, and understandably so, because, I mean, SsangYong is not a name that translates particularly well to Australia. And it's, you know, you've got 60 brands to choose from, so why are you going to go with an unknown? But there's actually a heck of a lot of merit to the car. Have you ever driven a SsangYong, either of you guys, particularly the Corando?
I did get to have a very brief drive of the Corando quite recently. And look, I agree with what you've said in the comparison, particularly with the powertrain. There's a good amount of punch off the line, and I really do appreciate these midsize SUVs that have, even if they're small displacement, a turbocharged four-cylinder engine instead of a naturally aspirated, because I've driven the Corando and I've driven the Tucson as well, and the Corando's definitely got the better powertrain there. It's just more responsive. You really don't have to wring its neck, and sounds better while you're doing it, so...
Well, the Hyundai makes its power 700 RPM higher up the rev band, but it makes its peak torque at 4,000 RPM, and it's only 205 newton meters, so not very much. And the SsangYong makes about 30% more torque, and it's only at 1,500 RPM. It's all on tap, all the way through the rev band. So you've got this instant punch that you don't get in the Tucson. And, you know, on the face of it, you go, well, okay, if I really break it down, and it's my mum who's asking me the question, do I buy the SsangYong or do I buy the Hyundai? I think there's still a pretty sound argument for buying the Hyundai, because it's a known quantity. You know exactly what you're going to get. There are hundreds of dealers if anything goes wrong, whereas SsangYong's only got sort of 45. You know, and it's not as if it's a complete stripper. But that SsangYong does enough, and it wins in enough areas that while you may have pause for thought over taking a punt on a brand you've never heard of, it's not a fait accompli that it's the loser. And I think, in a sense, it sounds a little bit glass half empty, but the fact that the SsangYong is not a definitive loser against a Hyundai, and in some ways is actually a better bet, says a lot about where that brand is coming from. Would I buy one? I'm a guy that places a lot of stock in brand equity, and I think the fact that Hyundai has got the runs on the board means that I'm more inclined to probably trust it. But there are a lot of people that just look at, you know, pure spec for money, and if
if you look at things through that lens, then you have to get the SsangYong. And I didn't think I'd be saying that. So I thought this Comparo piece was actually one of the more interesting ones that I've written in a while, purely because sometimes when you drive a product from an unknown brand, you don't really know what to expect. So, yeah, really interesting. I'd love to get your feedback, all you listeners as well. So please go have a read and leave a comment.
So you're able to divulge who the winner was?
The winner was, look, at the end of the day, I gave the win narrowly to the Tucson, 7.7 versus 7.6. It's got better infotainment. It's got a full-size spare wheel. It's got a slightly smoother ride, and it's obviously coming from a brand that has a lot more dealers and a lot more reassurance and brand equity in it. And obviously that plays a major role in things like resale value down the track. So I think as a sensible, smart family purchase, it's probably still the winner. But there were some areas, particularly engine punch, warranty and value for money, where the Carando did score more highly than the Tucson. And you've got this really nice balance here of it's not a unanimous win for the Hyundai by any means. There are four sections there that it loses. So narrowly the Hyundai, but only by the barest of margins.
Okay. I'll say this though. The SsangYong lineup now, today, is probably the most impressive lineup that they've ever had at any point in time in their history. And they've been around for a few decades. I think they've really turned a corner in recent years. They've obviously dropped their controversial design language that brought us things like the Stavic. And they're making some good-looking, well-equipped cars with a really good after-sales package. So it'd be very interesting to see how they go from here.
And look, I'm being a bit harsh. I'm sort of making it sound like SsangYong's this unheard of brand that no one's ever heard of. It has been around for more than 50 years in Korea. It is a pretty storied brand there. But in Australia, it's obviously much more of a minnow than Hyundai, which is the number three brand in the market. So it's not as if SsangYong just started up yesterday. But when you look at its R&D budget and its factories and its global footprint compared to its fellow Korean brands, it really is a bit of a minnow.
Well, you can let us know what you think of that comparison, which is live now at carexpert.com.au. Albor's fella, hello again.
How are you?
Very good. This week you've got in a, I suppose, would you call this a Regal SUV, the Range Rover SV autobiography?
Oh, I would probably call it one of the best SUVs on the planet. So really? I'm a huge fan of the full-size Range Rover, and the one that I had was a SV autobiography Dynamic, so it's about 400 grand, that thing. So I think we're talking proper SUVs here, not some sort of, you know, $100,000 car for the plebs, you know, which is what anyone driving this car would think, to be honest.
So what do you get for the money?
I don't really know. It's a good question. I think when you buy a Range Rover Sport, I feel like you get about 90% of the Range Rover. And it looks almost as good and all that sort of stuff. But for that extra 200,000+, you get a slightly bigger car and you just get a lot more status. This, especially in the SV biography, because I don't know, it's honest to God, there's not many cars you get into and you just don't want to get out of. And the car that I had was a really nice dark black color with a really nice red interior. And even my wife and my kids commented on just how beautiful it was. It was such a nice car to be in. Such a really good airy feel of cabin space and just, I kind of, in my review, I described it as the first class of motoring travel because it really felt like it, like especially the rear seats, you could fold them all the way down and, you know, squash the person in the front and really basically just go to bed in the back seat. It's a lot of money to pay for the privilege, but whenever I see one of those on the road, I'm sort of look at it with a hideous amount of envy.
Yeah. So, Boaz, riddle me this. When you look at the specs of a Mercedes GLS or a, you know, BMW X7, they don't really have anything missing that a Range Rover doesn't. They're not quite as good off-road, sure, but, you know, they've got all the stuff that a Range Rover has and their brands are at least as reputable in the luxury space. So why is it that there's just something about a Range Rover that the others can't touch? Why is it that a top-of-the-range Range Rover just impresses everybody more than any of the Germans, yet doesn't seem to offer more? How is that?
You know, it's a really good question, and I'm not really sure if there's any logical answer for it, but when you get into it, it answers it for you. From the soft leather to just You know, it's some of it just might be the command position that you sit in. You really feel like you're on top of the world, and the car is so quiet and there is so much room. And I don't know, it even smells good. Like, it's the first time I've sort of put my nose next to a seat and smelt it, because it just smells so nice. That leather is crazy. That GLS and the X7 are really nice cars. But, you know, for me, I think the reason why I don't necessarily rate those two as highly as I would a Range Rover is that they share a lot with their lesser cars. You know, like, you get into a X7 and there's a lot of stuff that you can see that come, you can find also in an X3. You get into a full size Range Rover and those seats and that the material they use and the fit and finish, you know, you're not going to find that in an Evoque. There's something unique about it. And that for me is really where it really stands out. I feel like I'm in something that I've actually paid for, rather than I'm in an X7, which kind of has a lot of parts shared across the entire model range.
I'm assuming that it is jam-packed full of features and tech. Was there anything to you that was missing, though?
Oh, it's actually got some of the world's worst tech. That infotainment system, in my opinion, is absolutely horrendous. It's so slow. It's sluggish. It just doesn't do what it's supposed to do half the time. But you know what? The rest of the car is so calm and peaceful and happy that I just don't really care. It's, there's no way that infotainment system would have anything on any of the German brands, Audi, BMW, or Mercedes. But the rest of the car makes up for it. Like, it's really hard to justify paying nearly $400,000 for that car, but I could see why you would.
Then again, it's not, because a Bentayga costs that much money, and a Range Rover just craps all over a Bentayga when it comes to presence and style.
I don't know about that. Do you reckon? I actually really like the Bentayga, mainly because it's so fugly that you kind of want to love it.
That's very true.
Yeah, but there's something that goes back to what we spoke about before. There's just something about big Range Rovers, isn't there? I don't know. There's just something unquantifiable about them that I don't think a Bentayga matches.
I think the difference is that the Bentayga looks like it's worth $400,000, because obviously it's got a Bentley badge on it. And for some people, that's not what they want to portray. But the Range Rover actually costs that much and has just as many luxuries, if not more, but can also blend in. Like, because a Range Rover, it could be a lot more subtle. Yes, it's an expensive car, but I think the majority of people that saw this, when I asked them how much they thought it was worth, they also went like 150 to 200. And when I told them the actual figure, they all nearly died, because it's ridiculous how expensive it is. But yeah, I mean, for some people that want an amazing car to go from their luxury house to their country house, that's what you'd buy and carry the horses with you.
I guess the difference is, as well, the Range Rover feels, well, it looks more old money, whereas the Bentley's a little bit flashier. It's a little bit blingier.
Which is amazing that I like it, because I usually hate old money cars, but this car is just truly just luxury at its peak.
You're the definition of nouveau riche, mate.
Apparently that's a derogatory term, but I've never taken offence to it.
New money, not derogatory at all. You're a bloke who came from very little and made a heap. Good on you. But it is interesting that there's a new Range Rover around the corner. We know that the new one isn't all that far away, because the current one's been around for a little while. What are the things that you reckon they need to do with the new generation one? Obviously, infotainment clearly is a priority, but what are some other things that you reckon Rangey need to do with the new one to elevate it even higher than the outgoing model?
Yeah, look, I think one thing before I answer that question that I sort of neglected to answer is that I know I'm quoting a price of around $400,000, but as we all know, if you walk into a dealership, you could probably get a substantial discount on that to get it well and truly in the low threes. And that sort of gives it a bit more perspective of where that car sits in terms of price. In terms of what I would love to see in the new one, to be fair, like I said before, and this is probably one of the reasons why the car appeals to people, so I don't know if they're going to change it, but there isn't enough distinction for me in the look department, especially from the front end, between a Range Rover and a Range Rover Sport. They do look quite similar. And when you're spending that amount of money, I feel like I would like it to look a little bit different. But again, it literally contradicts what I was saying before, where it can blend in. So I don't know. I think everything that's inside in terms of luxury is amazing. The infotainment, like you said, needs to change. I love that the car has a V8 in it and it sounds like it's got a V8 in it. And I really hope that they manage to somehow keep that engine despite all the emission changes. So I hope that it doesn't go quiet and soft and just plush and luxury. Because the other thing I love about this car is that whilst it is all of those things, when you really floor it and you put it into dynamic mode, it's a boat, but it sounds like a proper car. And that, you know, it kind of wakes you up every once in a while when you absolutely give it some, because not many cars like that come with a proper V8 that isn't turbocharged, so it still sounds pretty decent.
All right. Albor's fella, thank you so much for your time.
Thanks, guys. Speak to you soon.
That brings it into this week's podcast. What cars have we got in the garage in all three states next week, Moko?
Obviously, Victoria is on a bit of a go slow at the moment, understandably enough, so we're leaning much more heavily on our friends north of the border, including your good self, Will, but there are plenty of good cars coming through the Car Expert garages. We've got some Ute content underway with the new D-Max versus the Amarok and the Navara Warrior and the Ranger XLT sort of coming up, so we've had some delays on that content, but it's finally in the works. We've got a Mercedes-Benz GLE 53 Coupe, which is that kind of subtly hybridized 48-volt toting Tier 2 performance-driven SUV. We've got a Citroen C3 at the other end of the scale, the new Audi A4 Allroad, revisiting a couple of Jeep products. I know, Will, you're in a Mitsubishi Express van, the rebadged Renault Traffic up there in Brizzy, and a Golf GTI TCR, I think, has been through that garage relatively recently as well. So nice diverse spread of cars, really, utes and vans and performance cars, and trying to spread the love a bit.
Is Croft driving the C3? Please tell me he is.
It appears to be a Kurt Dupre jobby, that one. I think what's happened is we've loaded Crawford up with so many things to do lately, because obviously down in Melbourne we've been unable to do a lot of the launch drives, that we've given him more. I reckon he's written more reviews in the last month than he did in the 3 years previous to that, which says a lot about how much he's been doing. And I reckon we might have said, okay, maybe he needs to not get any more cars until he can clear the backlog.
Give the man a holiday.
I know, he's been carrying the team.
I was going to say, I did enjoy reading his Suzuki Ignis review, though, this week. I love when he gets into normal cars.
I think the thing that we all love about Crawford is his enthusiasm is not limited solely to Italian performance cars. He can find the joy in any car. And when you're a cynical grump like me, that's a trait that I think should be followed.
Yes.
His enthusiasm is infectious. I can just hear him in my head saying, it was sensational.
Yeah, it really is.
All right. Mike Costello and Will Stopford, thank you so much.
Thanks, Mandy.
Thanks, Mandy.